A high swimming risk continues through mid-morning at Lake Michigan beaches in Racine, Kenosha, and Milwaukee counties. So you'd be advised to stay out of the lake till sometime early in the afternoon. The numbers now, wind north of 10, humidity high at 89%, 63 Kenosha, 64 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I must confess to having learned a tremendous amount from reading a book called Ending Redlining through a community-centered reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. I must confess to having only the vaguest notion of what redlining is. And that, of course, speaks to the sort of privileged life that I have lived. But in fact, the practice of redlining has been a really destructive tool of discrimination for far too long in far too many places. And one of the ways in which the practice of redlining, that is, of the concerted efforts to exclude certain people from certain neighborhoods, the process of redlining was attacked, if you will, with something called the CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act. That was back in 1977, nearly half a century ago. And in this book called Ending Redlining, Josh Silver examines the CRA, what prompted it to be passed, the battle for its passage, and the reforms that have been made over the years, halting reforms in some cases, in certain cases, reforms that actually, in some ways, harmed the CRA and its effectiveness. And his book also calls for certain changes to be made that could make it still more effective. Josh Silver has been working on this issue for decades. He is a consultant and senior fellow at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, working to protect and strengthen the Community Reinvestment Act, fair lending laws, and data disclosure laws. For a time, he was a research associate at the Urban Institute in the District of Columbia, and for a time, development manager at MANA Incorporated, a local nonprofit housing developer based in the District of Columbia. This book has just been published by Arm & Lear, and it's again titled Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. And Josh Silver, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, your introductory remarks were very generous, and not many people know about redlining. So don't feel bad about that. and that was one reason I wrote the book.
Well, and I appreciate the fact that you take the time to explain it as you do. I would love to just take a moment to find out how it is that you have found yourself in this particular arena for such a long time. Did anything in particular prompt you to first take on this important issue in the way that you have?
Yeah, well, you know, all goes back to your experiences in your childhood. And when I was a kid, I actually had a learning disability and a speech impediment and a hearing disability. And you were bullied. And from an early age, I identified with the underdog, and I developed empathy. Part of it was the way I was raised by good parents. So in college, fast forward a few years, in college in New York City in the early 1980s, I noticed a huge increase in homelessness. And I thought to myself, how can you really stabilize your happy little life get a job, take a shower if you don't have a home. And that got me interested in the field of affordable housing and community development. Fast forward a few more years after working at the Urban Institute, I found the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, which cared about, has community organizations around the country, including a great one in Milwaukee. They care about neighborhoods, underserved neighborhoods, you know, providing affordable housing and community development. And the Community Reinvestment Act is a very important tool. It's a requirement imposed upon banks to serve all neighborhoods. It's a very important tool for doing that. And NCRC, you can think of as sort of a trade association of community organizations that seeks to promote and strengthen the Community Reinvestment Act and the Fair Housing Act and laws like that.
Ahead of us talking specifically about the CRA and its passage back in 1977, I think it would be good to take an even longer historical view if we could and find out a little bit about the way in which this practice of redlining came about. And I guess part of what we are talking about is that once upon a time, the exclusion of certain types of people from certain neighborhoods was quite overt. And my impression is, in many cases, in maybe most cases, rather unapologetic. It was not done something, you know, quietly behind closed doors, but rather brashly, and it would seem to be kind of heartlessly. You quote at one point in your book, the mayor of Baltimore, this would have been at some point in the 20th century, basically saying, blacks should be quarantined, and he was trying to enact policies that would, in effect, safeguard the rest of the community. Tell us more about kind of the brash, open way in which this discrimination took place, of course, for decades, and then what changed, what made it necessary, in a sense, for this kind of discrimination to take a different form.
Sure. You're absolutely right. This actually has been going on for hundreds of years in our country. It goes back to slavery and the genocide against Native Americans. Unfortunately, there's always a struggle in any society against good versus evil. In the 20th century, you identified correctly, there were segregationists that wanted to keep not only African Americans out of neighborhoods, but also, you know, I'm Jewish, also keep Jews out of neighborhoods, or in the early 20th century, other Eastern European immigrants. So as you indicate, you know, this practice was going on even in the early 1900s, but around the 1930s, ironically, during the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration, there was an agency called the Homeowners Loan Corporation, and they were rescuing people from a foreclosure and making refinance loans, and they wanted to get a sense of the riskiness of these refinance loans. So they engaged with practitioners in the private sector, appraisers, lenders, real estate agents, to help them draw maps, categorizing risk by neighborhoods. And neighborhoods were color-coded. Red was deemed the riskiest, and hence you get the name redlining. Your neighborhood would be color-coded red. And on the other end of the scale, green was deemed the least risky. Make loans as much as you want. All too often, it was the African-American neighborhoods and the Jewish neighborhoods that were color-coded as riskier. And so, also from the 1930s to 1960s, government-guaranteed lending through the Federal Housing Administration was really one of the major games in town for lending. And the FHA developed their own redlining maps. So for about three decades, there was virtually no or very little lending to African Americans or communities of color. And this systematically locked out African-Americans from the American dream of home ownership, which is providing for your families in a major means of wealth building. And it wasn't just redlining, though that was really bad. It was also discriminatory practices in the real estate industry, steering white borrowers to white neighborhoods and steering black borrowers to black neighborhoods. One other device that was declared illegal by the Supreme Court, or at least illegal for the government to enforce, was something called racial covenants, which said do not sell your house to an African American or a Jew. It was actually in the deed. You know, the Supreme Court said government can't enforce this in 1948, but private people still could. So you still had racial covenants. All of this combined to create really very different life chances for people of color and whites. And so in 1977, it was actually Senator from Wisconsin, William Proxmire, that joined forces with actually white ethnic advocates in Chicago. William Proxmire is the father of CRA. Gail Sincotta is called the mother of CRA. She is an advocate. And the white ethnics were trying to preserve integration. They had a multiracial coalition with African Americans and trying to prevent really destructive practices in the neighborhood. And they thought that if banks just provide responsible lending in all neighborhoods, that would really be very important in stabilizing neighborhoods, creating healthy lending markets, maintaining integration. So that's what caused CRA to be passed. It imposes an obligation on banks to serve all communities, including low and moderate income communities. And you know, so that's the background, and we can get a little more into how CRA works as well.
Absolutely. I think at this point, it would be really important to say something about why this issue is so incredibly important. And because I know during these years of the fight for this and in the efforts since to maybe lessen this law's impact or effectiveness, that that some people want to turn a blind eye to the harm that is done. I mean, it would probably say something about, you know, what's the big deal? Why can't person X live over here in neighborhood Y? Why do they have to live here next to me or down the street from me? And of course, your book, while this is not the primary focus of your book, you take the time to talk about the way in which a given person's life is affected and even damaged when someone else determines where you can or cannot live. Explain why it does make such a difference in terms of someone's well-being and their ability to succeed in the most sort of basic terms when this kind of discrimination in terms of where they can live is allowed to take place.
Yes, that's an excellent question. And I'll start by answering the organization I worked with for almost 30 years, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, has done excellent research on this. They actually used the redlining maps, or the maps that were drawn up by the Homeowners Loan Corporation, to identify census tracts that were considered the riskiest and to compare life chances in those census tracts with other census tracts that had healthy lending markets. And 80 years later, after the 1930s, you still see incredible disadvantages. You see differences in life expectancy of 5 to 10 years, that discrimination can decrease your life by 10 years. Increases in, you know, increases in high blood pressure, in asthma, high poverty rates in neighborhoods that were deemed riskiest for lending in the 1930s. And also, you know, what is discussed in the mainstream media is the wealth disparities and the home ownership disparities between African Americans and whites. And, you know, sadly, this was not by chance. This is by design, that 68% of whites own homes, and it's like 40% for African Americans, even decades later. So in my book, in chapter one, I talk about two people that have very different life chances. One was Freddie Gray in Baltimore, young man. He had lead poisoning because the housing stock, there was disinvestment from the housing stock, and they couldn't get financing to keep the housing stock up to code. So he had lead poisoning that dramatically limited his life. I won't go into the details, but it was not a happy ending. But in contrast, CRA requires banks to serve all communities in a part of Washington, D.C. called Anacostia. There has been homeownership lending and construction of affordable housing. And I end chapter one on an optimistic note with a woman named Sabrina Walls, who got a home loan, is a homeowner in a condominium complex in a formerly redlined neighborhood through the work of MANA, which is a housing nonprofit. And she will have equity in the coming years of $200,000 or more. And this is, you know, somebody who probably was a first-time homeowner in her family. And this equity provides, you know, she can send her kid to college if she wants. She can start a small business, and she could pass down the wealth. And that's the American dream. So, you know, you just contrast the tragic stories of disinvestment with the hope and the possibilities of reinvestment.
We're speaking with Josh Silver, and we're talking about his book, Ending Redlining, Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. It's an examination of this CRA passed back in 1977, intended to eradicate the practice of redlining, a law that was certainly well-intentioned and has accomplished much good, but a law that also over the years has required reform, and certainly requires reform now, at least in the estimation of Josh Silver and his colleagues at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Since you rightly underscored the fact that one of the chief authors of the Community Reinvestment Act was Wisconsin's own William Proxmire, I think it would be great if we could take a little bit of time to talk about what specifically prompted this act and the way in which it was crafted. And of course, we want to talk about the way in which it was ferociously opposed and only passed by the barest of margins. First of all, remind our listeners about who William Proxmire was in 1977. That is the position that he held in the U.S. Senate that made him and put him in the driver's seat, if you will, in the crafting of this proposed new law.
Well, he was a senator from Wisconsin, and he's a very interesting personality. One thing that's interesting about Senator Proxmire is he was not a traditional liberal in terms of having an expansive government spending to address social issues. He wanted to leverage the resources of the private sector. And he saw that, you know, there's redlining, banks were abandoning their responsibility to serve all communities. Because after all, banks get a charter from federal or state government, and in return for getting a charter, they really should serve all citizens of, you know, in their business footprint. In the book, I was able to talk to, you know, Senator Proxmire is no longer with us, but one of his staff, Robert Kuttner, that crafted, you know, the CRA language. And so it's really an incredible story. He was a very skilled legislator. He realized that you probably could not pass CRA on its own, so he attached it to a larger housing and community development bill. And the opposition was basically the free market perspective, that you can't have government interfering in the marketplace. But one thing that perspective overlooked is the government had interfered in the marketplace, you know, starting in the 1930s with the redlining maps and agreeing with the private industry, we are going to avoid certain neighborhoods. So society as a whole, government and private sector, had a big role in creating this problem. And Senator Proxmire thought that the private sector, with push from government, is responsible for addressing it.
You know, as you talked about the opposition of free marketers, I'm reminded of a wonderful Abraham Lincoln quote that you include a little bit later in the book, or at some point in the book, a quote that I'd never seen before, which says, "The leading object of government is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life." But that turn of phrase about lifting artificial weights from all shoulders, that is so pertinent for what we are talking about today, because, of course, when barriers have been put in place by man that discriminates against other men or other people, placing, in a sense, artificial weights on their shoulders, weighing them down, slowing them down, making all but impossible progress that many others would take for granted. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was really speaking in a way that resonates to this very day.
Yes, he was indeed a visionary. I've read a couple of books about Abraham Lincoln. John Meacham did a wonderful book. And he was referring to, of course, slavery. In his background, he grew up under an abusive father who basically exploited him and had him work for farmers for like nothing. So Abraham Lincoln, from an early age, had empathy. And back in those days, if you worked hard and you had 40 acres and a mule, you could succeed. So lift the artificial impediment of societal discrimination and give people a fair chance. And that actually would benefit everybody through a more prosperous society. So, you know, that he's a visionary. So that quote is really timeless. And after slavery, of course, Jim Crow and redlining and other forms of discrimination. So that quote is still very pertinent today.
As you outline what William Proxmire was proposing, it is just so interesting to see all of what was brought to bear in favor of this and all of the opposition to it. Describe to our listeners just what sort of a fight this was for successful passage of the CRA to finally be achieved.
Well, you know, coming in almost 50 years after passage, 1977, you know, one disadvantage that I had, I was only 13 in 1977 getting bombed, but, you know, I wasn't there. But I was able to interview people who were there, and you get their insights in the book. You know, a multiracial coalition was key. Talking about income rather than race was very important, because even then there was a backlash against affirmative action. And this is really more about lifting artificial weights, not, you know, benefiting, you know, any particular group because of the color of skin, you know, just making sure that everybody has a fair chance. You know, they were able to overcome that. He did a brilliant job holding hearings and having a lot of evidence and testimony from the community groups first. Usually these hearings are the regulators first, and then after the regulators speak, the community, all the media leave the room. You know, Proxmire did this the exact opposite, and it was very effective. But fast forward a few decades, there was still opposition to CRA because, you know, the free market ideology is powerful in this country, and you know, no one wants, you know, undue government interference in the way like a sneaker company, you know, shoe company works. But to make sure that there's no discrimination is very important. And one way I talk about later in the 1990s, when there was a movement to try to repeal or weaken CRA via legislation, is that advocates, you know, NCR, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, was just starting, Advocates were very effective in demonstrating the success of CRA. It's about affordable housing. It's about community development. And literally flooding congressional offices with newspaper accounts or taking members of Congress on walking tours. And this concrete demonstration of success, I think, was very important and was one reason why the law has been very durable. I don't think the law will be repealed even now, because there is an extensive, not only an extensive network of community organizations, but banks. There's a lot of banks who realize this is good business, and a lot of banks have CRA departments. So there's a lot of people who work for banks, and their job is to make sure that banks are finding profitable lending opportunities and investing opportunities in low and moderate income neighborhoods. And when there is, CRA has been under attack, banks have testified in front of Congress to preserve and, to strengthen this law. And that's, a testament to decades of really a CRA infrastructure developing in this country.
I want to get some clarification, and I think it would be helpful for our listeners as well, about exactly what CRA is and exactly how it works. At one point in your book, you say that the statute itself is just a few pages long, but CRA regulation is lengthy, and a CRA exam, which is part of kind of the process involved with this, can be hundreds of pages long. So help us make sense of that, about this statute that is relatively brief versus all that comes with it that is not so brief, not so succinct.
Yes. Well, let me just give you the bare bones of what it is and how it works. And so Congress passes a law, and the federal banking agencies, there's three of them, but, the Federal Reserve Board that most people are familiar with is one of them. And the way CRA is implemented is the federal banking agencies basically devise an exam that measures how many loans, investments, and services banks are offering to low and moderate income people in low and moderate income neighborhoods. Banks get a rating, outstanding and satisfactory, are like A and B on a report card. So those are the passing grades. And then there's two grades, needs to improve and substantial in our compliance. Those are the failing grades. And these grades, along with the exams, are publicly available. And the way I tell people to think about this is, imagine you're in high school and college and your math report card, or your report card's available on the internet. You would probably work a little harder in math and Spanish. So that's the idea. It's publicly available, and anybody can comment when the examiner is conducting the exam about how well banks are responding to needs and communities. So this has spawned hundreds of partnerships between nonprofits and banks to do things like affordable housing development or housing counseling to buy a home. So that's how CRA works. The other really key part of CRA exam is when banks of enforcement is when banks are merging. The agencies are required to review the performance of banks in responding to needs in their neighborhood, and that's also a very important part for enforcement. And you're right, for the largest banks in the country, a CRA exam can go on for hundreds of pages. But that's because, think of Bank of America or Wells Fargo, they serve like 20 or 30 states. Smaller banks, but not as big, don't have exams that go on for hundreds of pages. Maybe a bank that serves the state of Wisconsin, for example. The exams are tailored to the size of the bank and take into account differences in capacities. And then also I'll say real quick, during a merger application, when one bank wants to take over another one, they are legally required to demonstrate a public benefit and to demonstrate how their CRA performance will not decline. So one thing that has happened is this is not required by CRA, but community benefits agreements have been negotiated between community groups and banks. One way for banks to demonstrate their public requirement to demonstrate a public benefit. And in these agreements, banks have pledged to make more loans and investments in the future than the two banks were making previously. And to give you one statistic, since 2016, 22 community benefits agreements negotiated by CRA and its members, committing banks to $588 billion for home and small business lending and community development finance. And there is an increase in lending and investing after the CBAs, as that impressive number can tell you. So this has been a very effective law to empower communities that were formerly discriminated against. Hmm.
By the way, I don't remember from your book, have there been any serious court challenges to CRA over the years? That is, have people come forward saying that this is a law that is unconstitutional and should and be abolished, or has the resistance to CRA over the years been of a more subtle nature?
Well, it's very interesting because the bank trade associations want CRA for their non-bank competitors that don't have CRA, like, you know, large mainstream credit unions, some of whom don't have a great fair lending record, actually. Or mortgage companies that are not depository institutions. And we actually agree with the bank trade associations on that point. On the same, but on the other hand, sure, banks want CRA. I think they've given up the fight to repeal CRA because they don't have the votes. But they want a weaker form of CRA, or from the perspective of community organizations. So over the years, the debate and discussion has revolved around the CRA regulation, which really designs the CRA exams. How tough or how lenient are those exams going to be? The nicer word to describe this is the more rigorous the exams are, the more loans and investments you're going to get in neighborhoods. So community groups want a robust exam. And, you know, just to give you an example of this, in 2023, the Biden administration, the people in the bank agencies that were appointed by the Biden administration did a very good reform to make performance measures on the exams more objective. And also, just one other example of this, in 1995, when the last big changes of the regulations were done, we didn't have the internet, basically. In 2023, we do, and there is a lot, not most banks, but there are a good number of banks that are making a high volume of loans through the internet. So you have to think about how you are going to adapt CRA to take into account lending beyond the bank branches. And that's what the 2023 reform did, very simply, where banks are making a lot of loans, but they don't have branches. We're going to look at that lending activity or that investment activity. The bank trade associations challenged it in court. That's your question. It wasn't the basic constitutionality of the law, but it was an allegation that the agencies went beyond the CRA statute. The CRA statute really just talks about lending where the bank branches are. We disagreed with that. And in fact, even in 1977 hearings, there was a representative from the American Bankers Association that said, you know, you can't really only hold us accountable for, say, lending in the big cities, because suppose those needs are met, like lending in Milwaukee, but we want to also serve rural Wisconsin. So that witness in 1977 basically anticipated one of the big issues of CRA today, that CRA really encourages banks to serve all underserved communities, not only where they have branches, but wherever they're making a lot of lending activity. You just can't make loans to a lot of rich people in rural America, for example. And actually, the original CRA language, the focus only where banks were, where the bank branches were, that original language was actually tweaked to give room for CRA exams to look at all performance in underserved communities broadly. We think our side would have prevailed in court. It also depends on the judge you get. But sadly, the Trump administration came into town, elections have consequences, and the 2023 regulatory reform The Trump administration has announced its intention to repeal it. I think it's a sad day because I do think that the regulations should go beyond the world as it was in 1995 to really maintain, you know, robust lending and investing activity throughout all of our communities.
We're speaking with Josh Silver, talking about his book, Ending Redlining, Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. We're talking about the CRA that was passed back in 1977, and Josh Silver's book examines the history of that act, how it has changed the landscape, the ways in which the CRA itself, the Community Reinvestment Act, has been altered, reformed, refined, in certain cases rolled back, and the book also sets out some proposed changes, I mean, some ways in which Josh Silver believes the CRA could be still more effective than it is. I found especially interesting in the sixth chapter of your book, which is titled Rollback, a discussion about one point in time when the CRA was very much weakened. And if I understand it, it's because the landscape of lending was changed dramatically with laws that allowed for new kinds of mergers and so on. And because the CRA itself was left out of that, it suddenly did not apply to this new landscape, or not to all of the institutions that suddenly formed. I'm probably being very simplistic. Maybe I'm even being incorrect. But is that at least sort of the essence of what occurred at this point?
Actually, you're being very accurate and concisely saying basically exactly what happened. In 1999, Congress passed a law that's referred to as the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, or the three congressional authors of the law. And leading up to 1999, the industry, they all wanted to merge. City Financial, or Citigroup now, kind of forced the hand because they wanted to. They were acquiring a huge insurance company called Travelers, and up until then, there was strict separation between commercial banking, retail banking, insurance, securities. That arose after the Great Depression, when there was too much riskiness being taken on the part of by retail banks. Keep these activities separate, particularly since banks get federal deposit insurance. They basically, in 1999, a bank holding company was allowed to not only own banks, but to own insurance companies and securities firms. And our position was, if you're making the industry more powerful and stronger with more market share, you also have to expand community reinvestment obligations broadly throughout the industry. You know, think about insurance companies. They offer premiums to individuals. So it's important to make sure that they're not discriminating against modest income people or people of color. Securities firms, that's wealth built. Is it possible to extend a community reinvestment obligation to them? We think it is. And we worked with members of Congress to propose CRA modernization legislation. One other instance of this is banks own mortgage companies today. And it is optional on the part of banks whether they want their mortgage company activity included on a CRA exam. And to us, from the community's perspective, that's a big loophole, because a mortgage company can either be doing something abusive, which has happened, and it's not on a CRA exam, or just not serving low and moderate income people. So that loophole, we also think, needs to be closed. Some states have closed some of these loopholes by extending CRA to mortgage companies like New York and Illinois, but most have not, and this has not happened on the federal level. Perhaps someday when the political landscape is more favorable.
I want to be sure to ask you about this matter that we talked about earlier, the CRA exams. So this would be the means by which a given lending institution, a bank or whatever, would be assessed in terms of how well they are doing in in lending in a way that encourages reinvestment in certain struggling communities. And at one point when you talk about these exams, which again are sometimes several hundred pages long, you raise the possibility of these exams being perhaps shortened, made more efficient, and made more rigorous. And that's kind of interesting to think about shortening an exam and making it more rigorous. What do you and your colleagues at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition believe should be done in terms of the alteration of these exams?
Well, I'll give you an example of this. There is one measure on the lending test is percent of loans to low and moderate income people, like percent of home purchase loans to low and moderate income people. And the particular bank is, say, Bank of Main Street, is compared to its peers. Bank of Main Street is making 15% of its loans to low and moderate income people, and the other banks in the area, say Milwaukee, are making 20% of its loans. So on that measure, Bank of Main Street probably would not get an outstanding rating. But the agencies will go through the geographical areas in the CRA exam, and you almost see the same paragraphs. You know, Bank of Main Street made a certain percentage of loans to low and moderate income people. The peers made, you know, Y percentage of loans to low and moderate income people. Low and moderate income people constitute X percent. Why do you have to do that each time? It's like, you know, the same paragraph. And if you do that in 20 geographical areas, it gets really long. On the other hand, you could just have very clear tables or charts and tell at the very beginning of the exam, okay, if, you know, we are giving, this will correspond to a B, how the bank compares to its peers and the demographics. This corresponds to an A. This is how you read the tables. And in 20 of the 30 geographical areas, the bank gets an A on its lending to low and moderate income people. In 10, it gets a B minus. So overall, the grade's going to be a B plus. So if you do it that way, you can dramatically cut down the amount of verbiage and the number of pages on a CRA exam, and at the same time, make it more rigorous and make it easier for people to understand. And I could also talk about the investment part of the exam and, you know, looking at bank branches and services, but I think you get the idea.
I think this is at least related to something else that you would like to see, which is more penetrating analysis of the numbers. I mean, it's one thing to have a mountain of numbers, a mountain of statistics, but if you're not looking at them properly and in a way that truly and honestly assesses the situation and the performance of that particular bank, then you really have a serious problem.
Yes, that's right. So, you know, we just spent a moment talking about the quantitative measures on the exam. But what's also very important is the qualitative analysis. But it's also important to do the qualitative analysis carefully so it doesn't become subjective or inconsistent. And what I mean by that, you know, I give this example in the book. In some cities that are experiencing gentrification, you will have instances of banks actually financing property owners that are slumlords and that are displacing long-time low and moderate income renters from their property so they can convert the property to upscale luxury housing. And this is not meeting needs. This is actually being very destructive and doing the opposite of meeting needs. But this type of qualitative analysis, it's not just counting loans or financing in low and moderate income communities. Is that financing really benefiting low and moderate income communities? And there was an effort in the 2023 regulatory update to address these qualitative factors and to make them more consistent and objective. You know, this will still be an issue that will still be very salient on CRA exams in the coming years.
Hmm. We have just a minute or two left, but I wonder if you have any final thoughts to share in terms of how you would like to see the CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act, further improved.
Well, I'll end with this, that, you know, when we learned that the incoming administration will repeal the 2023 regulation, of course we are very saddened because, you know, a lot of us, not only advocates, but people within the agencies worked decades to try to get the regulation to where it was in 2023. But nevertheless, you're sad for a day, you dust yourself off, and you keep advocating. And one thing that I think is very important, CRA has a lot of tangible, concrete success stories. Look at the affordable housing development down on Maple Avenue. Look at the small business corridor on Main Street. You walk your members of Congress literally through these streets. You document through case studies in communications with your members of Congress and also your local and state elected officials. And I think once you do that, and also banks will keep speaking out in favor of CRA, I think CRA is going to survive, and in another day we'll have an opportunity to strengthen it. So I'm cautiously optimistic, despite the moment that we are in right now, that CRA will not only survive but thrive in the coming decades. It's already been around for 50 years. I think it's going to be around for many more decades. Mm.
The book again is Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act, published by Armin Lear and the author Josh Silver. Josh Silver, thank you so much for the good work that you have done on behalf of this important issue over the years. Thank you for writing this fascinating and illuminating book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was great to speak with you. Best wishes.
It was a pleasure speaking to you, Greg. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm happy to share with you an interview I recorded last week with Yvonne McDonald, Executive Director of HALO, which is the largest homeless shelter in Racine. We will be finding out about how HALO operates, all of the different resources that it offers, and we'll discuss some of the root causes of homelessness in Racine and in other communities. On Wednesday, Linda Guy joins us in what has become a very happy midsummer tradition to talk about the Four Seasons Garden Club's Secret Garden Walk. This allows people the chance to explore what are otherwise private gardens and to explore their beauty. We'll talk about that on Wednesday. On Thursday, Kaylin Palomares pays her monthly visit to the program, and we'll have two brand new author interviews for you on Friday, one with the author of The Crucial Years, the other with a reporter for The Hollywood Reporter talking about his new novel, In Pursuit of Beauty. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast calls for partly sunny and pleasant conditions today. We're headed for a high of 79 degrees. A high swimming risk continues for another hour or so on Lake Michigan. You should be avoiding the beaches of Milwaukee, Racine, and Kenosha counties until a little later today. Tonight, clear skies, a low of 63, partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 83 degrees with a slight chance of a rain shower. Very similar forecasts on Wednesday and Thursday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Receiving.